There was an idea to bring together a group of remarkable people to see if we could become something more.
So when they needed us, we could fight the battles
that they never could.
This is the road to infinity.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me. Girl, you just don't realize what you do to me. When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's alright.
All right, welcome to Road to Infinity. I'm your host, Kyle. That was Blue Swede with Hooked on a Feeling. That was used in the campaign for the movie we're going to be discussing today, Guardians of the Galaxy. With me today, I have Rob.
Hello.
Hey, thank you to have you back. You were with us on our Iron Man 3 episode.
Yes.
So now we're going to get in. We're going cosmic. We're going to talk about the Guardians of the Galaxy. I picked that song, particularly not only because it's good, it's a nice high energy thing, but they used that in the first trailer. That was the first time we'd ever seen kind of what James Gunn was doing, and it was a big surprise to everybody about why you're using this song. What this movie doesn't look at all like we expected. And I think that's what you can say pretty much about all of Guardians of the Galaxy. It's unexpected.
Absolutely, yes.
From top to bottom, it's a complete surprise.
Well, I had my note in that in the alternate title, this is where Disney channels their inner 14-year-old boy.
That's true. I would say probably of all the ones, this is the one I feel the most. I mean, obviously, with the Russos, we're given a lot of creative freedom too. But I feel like this is the most where they're just like, yeah, we don't get it, but clearly you have an idea, so go ahead.
Well, have some things to talk about. There's some actually current movies in the Marvel Universe that have this movie to thank for some of their comedic elements.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's the whole just sensibility of it, the music. Yes. I mean, like, we wouldn't have a lot of the stuff that's coming out now if we didn't have the Guardians. Is a huge game changer for it. But
absolutely,
Before we dig into it, let's roll back a little bit and talk a little about the comics. Okay, so Guardians of the Galaxy in the comics in the original inception are a little... Well, they're complicated. So I'm going to try and sort of hit the high points here and not dig into it really well because things get a little weird. So Guardians of the Galaxy, the title, since it was used for a team in the Marvel Universe, a cosmic team kind of like this that out in the future sort of, you know, righting wrongs and doing these things, but they were in the future of the Marvel Universe. So they were in like the 30th century, sort of like a Legion of Superheroes if you're a DC fan. Like, they were way out there. They were characters who were inspired by the legend of the Avengers. And even one of the characters actually carried Captain America's shield, which, you know, because it's vibranium, nothing ever happens to it. It had survived to that time. They were father, but they are none of the characters from this movie. They were a completely different group that were out there doing that. And then at some point, they time travel back and they met some of the characters, and some of them lived, some of them died, and the team sort of went away. They were originally created in 1969, so they weren't around a lot. When I started reading comics and stuff too, they were sort of something that was around. They did have a little revival in the 90s and stuff too, as most things did. But then they were sort of just off on the side. Then what happened is two guys sort of had this great idea. So Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning were big comic guys, a team. They're two writers together. And so they had this idea about, there's these great cosmic characters in Marvel that Marvel wasn't doing anything with. And so they went and said, you have this whole pocket, this whole side of your universe that you're not touching at all. Let us sort of revitalize it. And it wasn't just them. There was a bunch of other, Keith Giffen and things that came along with them. But these are the two guys who did a lot of stuff with Guardians. So they said, let us do something big. And so they came up with this storyline called Annihilation, which is a big crossover. And all these characters sort of got revived and brought back. And one of the things they did, they brought a bunch of characters together, a ragtag group of misfits and miscreants and people who didn't get along. And they were inspired by this team that had time traveled back to call themselves the Guardians of the Galaxy. And they were led by Peter Quill. But the Peter Quill from the Marvel Universe is actually much, much older. He's more the, let's say, Kurt Russell age. he was a grizzled veteran who had seen all this war and stuff, and he was sort of like haunted and things too. He was smart and he was still cocky and stuff too, but he'd been through it. He was a veteran. So he put this group together of getting Rocket Raccoon and Groot, and that's where and all these things that came from. So all the characters that are here were people he had sort of assembled to help fight in this cosmic war, but not really in this formation, this incarnation, and he was not Han Solo.
So, got it.
I'm not trying to insult what James Gunn did at all. Like, I'm perfectly happy with the reinvention, but as a comic fan who loved that series and loved and of course from Annihilation, then they spun out all these other individual series. Guardians of the Galaxy had their own series for a while, and Nova has its own series for a while, and a bunch of the other characters too. And then sort of that sort of cosmic period sort of came to an end. They kind of like faded away, and then this movie came back, and all of a sudden it sort of revitalized them again. And so now Peter Quill in the current Marvel Universe looks just like Chris Pratt. It's amazing. They've done some, like, as Marvel tends to do when something is really super popular, they tend to retrofit it back into the universe. So Peter Quill now is suddenly 30 years younger with no explanation, and you know, he's cocky and he wears the headphones, and so, you know, they know when the getting's good. So that's basically where the comics are. So this, all this stuff that happens in here is, I would say, in the spirit of the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, it is a remix. They took elements from all these kind of things and just remixed it into its own thing. So there are familiar things, and it is in a way, it is a love letter to the Marvel Universe, because there's so many little bits and bobs that James Gunn put in only the hardcore fans would either notice or respond to, that you have that feeling of when something shows up, you're like, oh, it's that guy. Oh, it's the thing. Oh, they're talking about. And it's all things that we as hardcore nerds know, but it doesn't distract enough that someone who doesn't read the comics, who had never heard of Nowhere or Cosimo or any of those things, would really, you know, get annoyed by. It's something that it works on multiple levels, which is a very, very difficult thing to do. And a lot of times we talk about the strange alchemy of these movies, and giving a big opportunity like this to James Gunn at this point in the career, and we're in August of 2014, if I hadn't mentioned that before, was a very, very risky thing, because James Gunn was not known for anything. I don't want to discount the guy, but I had seen his entire movie career, both of them. But I think it was that they were looking for someone new, something visionary, and he came in with the pitch. And I think he even published this online, his original pitch for Guardians 1, and it was this kind of thing. It was rock and roll. It was the 80s music. It was this dysfunctional family. Like, he had a real take on this that probably no one else could do, because Guardians of the Galaxy was a long shot. You get the guy in the iron suit, you get that, and you get, like, okay, the Thunder God, all right, you managed to do that. The super soldier, sure, okay. But it's all Earth. It's all terrestrial. It's all people on Earth doing Earth things. This is totally not that. This is way far out in the farthest reach of the universe and barely even touches on Earth. Of course, it starts there, so we have our human character that we're following. But it's so far out in the wacky cosmic universe that all these strange things and strange creatures and aliens thing that you could very, very easily have gone wrong.
You gotta love the idea of how that pitch meeting went, where, like, Mr. Iger, this guy's got an idea for Guardians of the Galaxy, and he's like, what has he done? Well, he did that alien leech movie, you know, like, your calling card is Slither, and you're like, wait, what?
That's, yeah, awesome. And I'm not a big horror fan, but I saw Slither even before I knew who it is, mostly because Nathan Fillion is in it.
Right.
So I watched it and I was like, yeah, this is okay. Like, I remember actually, I remember, it goes back to, I went to a panel at Comic-Con in San Diego, and James Gunn was there talking about Slither, and at the time he was nobody, and he and Nathan Fillion were there, and I was like, oh, okay, and I ended up like buying the movie when it came out and saw it, and haven't watched it since. I mean, it's not a bad movie, right, but it's not my thing. Like, it is very much of a horror movie. It's a gross out horror movie. It's like, it's slugs crawling into people's ears and eyes, and yeah, it's got a sense of humor a little bit. This is why I'm not a Marvel executive, because there's no way I would look at a movie like Slither and go, this is the guy we should give $100 million to.
Exactly, exactly.
Because he came up through Troma. Troma, for those of you who don't know, is the ultimate in low-budget thing. They got big in the late 70s or early 80s by following sort of the Roger Corman model of, let's make super gross-out horror-type movies or action movies or whatever you want, for as cheap as we possibly can, and like trying, and they built a cult following essentially, and also a lot of people were sort of trained on their stuff too, because it was, how fast can you write the script, how fast can we shoot this, how cheap can we make these special effects? And from that you got like the Toxic Avenger, and you got Tromeo and Juliet, I mean all these real cult films. And then, but at the time you could have a career doing that because you could put it out in the video stores, you know, for half what they're paying for copies of E.T. or Back to the Future or whatever the big thing was, and it fills the shelves, and there's a whole generation that was sort of raised on this sort of gross out, cheap, fun, crazy horror stuff. And this is where James Gunn was basically schooled in film. Like, he came in and joined that group, and you know, he was a page, and he worked his way up, and he eventually was writing in, I believe, as I'm trying to remember his full biography, but he came up through Troma, right. So much so that he actually gave a cameo, which we'll talk about when we get to it in the movie. There's a shout out to Troma.
Now you're missing the gratuitous nudity part of that.
Oh,
Troma.
Yes, you're right. So I forgot sex and violence. I really think about the violence and the gore, and there's also,
and
yes,
comical. Like, I mean, comical. Sex and violence.
Yes. Yes, it is. That is very much not for everyone. No, so I would say it is a very, very specific flavor, yeah, that you want to. So I won't go say run out and see all these movies. There are some that are good. There are some that are awful. And even you know, Lloyd Kaufman would say, the founder of Troma would say, yeah, that's by design. so this is where James Gunn sort of came from. So there, you can see a lot of that in his stuff too. There's a little bit of the bladder, a little bit of the gross out stuff that he likes to do. What comes to mind is the opening scene from Guardians 2, which I know we won't talk about now, but there's a lot of the people covered in ick. You know, he likes right. that kind of stuff. Yeah, so let's get into talking about Guardians of the Galaxy. I would say another one of the pitch, you know, like he's like, it's rock and roll, it's space, it's shooting, it's aliens, it's monsters. So how does it start out? It starts out with a kid's mom dying.
I gotta say, okay, wow. So I remember, we go to see this, and you know, my wife will, you know, my daughter of course is excited. My wife's like, okay, whatever, and she's like, okay, this is a superhero movie with a raccoon and a walking tree. 90 seconds into this movie, she turns it to me and goes, are we in the right movie? Because that opens,
yeah.
And honestly, the more you see it, I mean, I remember sitting there and just going, this is a brilliant opening, because it, one, it starts the hero's journey.
Yes.
In a, you tremendously understand, wow, where this is going to, you know, where this starts, at least not knowing where it's going to go. And two, for anybody who was dragged to that movie, they're immediately like, okay, this is something I've never seen this before. You know, this type of opening for this type of movie.
Right.
Okay. You've got me curious now.
Yeah.
I think it's a brilliant opening.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And something that none of us, yeah, like you said, none of us expected to go in the, you're meeting this kid, and it's the 80s, and his mom is dying, and he's uncomfortable and embarrassed, and he can't face her. And then she dies, and he's upset. And then he gets kidnapped by aliens and roll the Marvel logo. And it's like, what's happening right now?
what a absolute sucky week for Peter's extended family.
Yes.
Like, don't you think, okay, mother dies, which of course is horribly sad from cancer, and then on this same night, like, he goes missing, he's abducted.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're like, what?
Yeah, that was a rough time. So then we jump forward in time, and we're it's 2014. Now, from what I understand, everything we've seen of Guardians has happened in 2014, because from 1 to 2, it actually is supposedly only be a couple months. So everything that happened is in there. So we get to meet the grown-up version of Peter Quill, and he is on a planet going around. You see him use that cool sort of spectral scope where he recreates what this planet used to be. And then we see a cameo from the director's dog. He always puts his dog in every movie.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about Chris Pratt. So Chris Pratt, at this point, was known as a comedian. He had been on Everwood. It was actually more dramatic. He played sort of a jock in that one. But Everwood was a WB show that not a lot of people watched. It was very under the radar. It's a very good show that's worth going back to if you're into that kind of stuff.
That Treat Williams is in that, right?
It was. It was Treat Williams. It was Treat Williams as a big city doctor who moves with, after his wife dies, he moves with his son to a small I'm going to say Colorado town.
Right.
And it was, and then so then across the street from them live Peter Quill and Agent 13. because the boy, the his girl that the, of course the boy suddenly like sees and is the love, you know, that he falls in love with, would go on to play Agent 13 in the Captain America movies, and then her older, really kind of a jerk at the start of it, jock brother was Chris Pratt. But they both did a great job of it too. It's much more of a dramedy in the way that CW used to do it in those days. But so he led from that to being on Parks and Rec. He had put on a bunch of weight, and so he was like sort of the bigger, jolly doofus. I think they talked about him being on set as being like a giant golden retriever. He was just like big and silly, and he was great on Parks and Rec. I mean, he was one of the best parts of it, and they sort of molded the character that he played, Andy, to what he was like, because Andy also was kind of a selfish jerk at the start of it, and then he became this sort of a lovable idiot as the show went on, and Chris was amazed at that. And so he gets this job, and sort of the rest of the, we go, really? That guy? From there? But I think I can't even think of another, maybe only a handful of times when you can watch a movie and see the birth of a movie star.
Oh my God, yes.
And I would say in this one, he's on the planet and he stops and he puts the headphones on and starts dancing and the logos hit. And I was like, that's a goddamn movie star.
No, I got my note is literally the music, the walk, the title.
Yes.
Because that has got to be, first of all, I mean, like, what an amazing, like, just you just get the entire essence of the character. But when they do that awesome wide shot of him dancing at the bottom of the screen, and then literally just Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes.
I mean, talk about the greatest branding birth. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
And at that point, it was like we could all collectively unclench because, like, okay, we're in the hands of a master craftsman.
Absolutely.
Here. Like,
absolutely.
He knew exactly what he was doing. It's like, oh, all right, like, buckle in then, because I'm on board. Like, I even, my dad has not seen most of the Marvel movies. And I sat out, like, we just happened to be the timing, it showed up on FX and we were on it at a holiday gathering. And I'm like, old man, like just sit down here, just watch. I'm not going to tell you anything, but just sit down and watch this. And by the end of that sequence, he was like, what is this movie? Like,
yes, absolutely.
He was so, I mean, he's in his 70s, and he was like, what's the story? What's going on? Like, he was into it. He wanted to know.
For every one of our grandfathers and fathers, right, in their 60s or 70s, this movie is the fountain of youth for them.
Yeah. Because it is, I mean, you can draw a direct line from, like, Buck Rogers to this. One of the things that you could tell was very much influenced of it was Farscape. Farscape's one of my favorite television shows, and it's that same kind of thing of a human, a dude, essentially, they almost look alike, sent across the galaxy, surrounded by aliens and can't get back, and uses his knowledge of pop culture to basically like amuse himself, essentially knowing that no one else around him is going to understand what he's talking about. And people sort of made that comparison, and James Gunn was quick to say, yes, absolutely. And so much so that he actually put a Farscape cameo in volume two, just to be like, yeah, I'm aware of it. But the trope is nothing new. I mean, we've seen it a bunch of different times, but the fish out of water, you know, basically the dude sent across time or space in a whole new environment, but done extremely well. So then he's on looking for this thing. And this is where one of my problems with the movie comes in, because it's called Guardians of the Galaxy, but it really could have been called Subcontractors of the Galaxy, because I don't understand Thanos' plan. Okay, so I know this is getting into plot stuff here too, but just because Korath shows up here. So Korath is working for Ronan, and Ronan is working for Thanos. Thanos wants an Infinity Stone, which we don't know at this point. We know it's the orb. So presumably they got inside information that this is where it was stored. I don't know. Off screen, let's say that a historian's notes were suddenly published that says, oh, it's actually on this deserted planet. That's where it is. So Thanos, one of the six most powerful things in the universe, asks someone else to get it for him. Why? If you know where, why don't you just go and get it? Why do you have to float your floating chair?
Yeah, no, because as you find out later, sitting on your floating chair looking out into the abyss of space is hard work.
I guess So I mean, it's obviously none of this is known at the time you're watching the movie. You're just like, you know, you're going along. It's a guy doing a heist. That's fine.
Yeah, you're just like exactly.
So Thanos' plan is there's one of the most powerful things in the universe. I'm going to send a crazy Kree zealot to get it for me. Oh, all right, he's tough. I'll give you that. So here, the Animus and my daughters. There you go. Then you got everything you need to go get my orb. So Ronan goes, yeah, I'm super powerful. I have the two awesome ladies. I'm going to send Korath. You go get it. And then somehow the Ravagers, the worst of the worst, like low-end pirates, everything, also are on the trail of this thing. And now I get that nobody knows what it is. That's fine. But why is there so much subcontracting?
The only thing that I could probably explain that is,
yeah,
is that the Infinity Stones, I think at this point, at least perceived in the MCU, is
yes,
they're almost legends.
Yes.
Meaning they may or may not exist anymore. Right. Maybe they're gone. And maybe the idea is that, you know, you get this, you find out this map on the back of a napkin. Hey, I'm not going to waste my time doing this. You go find and see if it's there. I mean, that's the only explanation I come up with.
Yeah, but I feel sorry for Korath, because like he is such the eighth man out in this movie. Like he says, this poor guy, he's had nothing to do and why he's even around. I don't know why that they didn't send one of the sisters to do it. I don't know. All I can say is that what I have heard is that James Gunn has been nothing but praised with Marvel. He says the only thing that, if he could go back and change it, apparently the Marvel ruling council was very involved in the villain side of this movie. So I'm thinking a lot of this stuff was handed down to him, that you can't have Thanos. Like you can't, he can be in the movie, but you can't have him do anything.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Cause he was very diplomatic and very cool about it, like that. I mean, we've seen like he has a very good relationship with Marvel, and he's now one of the people who's like an architect of phase 3 and phase 4. But that was the one thing that he sort of let slide about, like, yeah, that's the part that I didn't have a lot of input on and I had to just take it as it was. I was like, and that kind of would explain
something. Oh, wait, I got to say this, actually. I hate to go back. You know, the one thing I forgot to mention, Do you know that the kid who plays the young Star-Lord, do you know who that is?
I don't know who that is.
He is one of the child actors from It.
Oh, really?
Yes. I think his name's Wyatt Olef.
Okay.
And he plays the kid who's got the demon flute player. He's the Jewish kid in It.
Oh, wow. Yes. That's cool. Sorry. Good for him.
I have a couple, because there's a couple of really great, you know, there's a couple of great crossover actors in this movie. This is one of them. I forgot to mention that. Sorry.
Yeah. So we get to see, poor Korath. But we get to see Star-Lord, you know, first of all, that no one knows who he is. He's just some low end Ravager at this point, but being a badass, like that first opening thing of him, like throwing down the gravity well and then like dropping down and calling the guys Ninja Turtles and blasting his way out of the, I mean, like, it's just a great, it's just a great action sequence. And you also get to see a lot of it because he's not the Punisher. He's not going to mow these guys down. His goal in that is to get the hell out of there.
Exactly. Like,
it's run, which I think is fantastic. So we see him fight through. So then we come to my next problem. So the thing is, I'm not ragging on this movie. I love Guardians of the Galaxy. I have seen it. I can't even count how many times. But it's like 95% perfect to me. But it's the flaws just stick out that much more because the rest of it is so good. So I know Rob is as big a fan, if not bigger fan than I am. So he'll be like the cheerleader in this one. So I'm not trying to bring him down. I'm not trying to say everybody's wrong for unequivocally loving this. There's just a couple things that I wish they could fix that always just like, oh, they just stick out to me because the rest of it is so freaking good. And one of them is about to happen right here. So Peter launched the big space thing. He gets in the ship and he flies away and he's going away. And suddenly, hey, there's a girl on board. And we meet Marit, and he doesn't remember her name because he's an asshole. Like,
yeah,
it's like, why? Well, yeah. Why? I understand the journey. Like, he has to be a better person by the end of it. But it's like, you already shown him to be funny and tough and, you know, smart and getting out of stuff, and he has to be an asshole that doesn't remember that he doesn't even remember the name of the girl he slept with the night before. Great. Thanks. Super.
I think that is part of the hero's journey of him is, is attachment. Okay, so we'll talk about this several times throughout this, but one of the main undertones of this movie is families are built with sacrificial love. I actually believe that. I think that's the thread that runs throughout this. Because he couldn't take his mother's hand, all his mother wanted is just take my hand. I'm about to die. Take my hand. No, I can't do that because I can't. It's too scary to me. There's too much hurt. I'm not going to do it. Takes off. She dies. The rest happens, right? He has no ability to really, I mean, it's a commitment story, obviously. But for him, it's I can't go into a deep attachment with other people. Everything is superficial. So I think that's when the girl pops up. And I will say, I have in my notes, that moment is the moment where I go, when she pops her head up and he's like, and you're like, okay, this is his, you know, summer fling or whatever.
Yeah.
I go, this is a Disney movie? Like, and there's a lot of those moments to come movie.
Oh, no, yes. Pun
intended. Like, literally, like, you just went, whoa, this is the movie where Disney goes, yeah, we're gonna pull back the judicial part of our like rating standards and practices. Yeah, they're gonna take a nap for this movie. So I think that's what the purpose of that scene is.
Okay, I can kind of see that. It still irks me. I mean, and I get the Arrested Development thing because he's still sort of playing out like he's a cowboy essentially. Like he's still living life because he got taken when he was and I get the environment he was raised in from that point. That he was, it's a bro culture. He's surrounded by these tough guys who want to eat him and all this, that he's had to fight to survive. And I get, and probably I would not think the Ravagers are that respectful of women.
Right.
No, there are no women on their crew, as far as I can tell.
And was it also part of a foreshadowing? Is she not the same race as the collector's slaves?
I believe so. They never really call them out, but there's a whole race of pink skinned. I'm not sure what the race is supposed to be. I wonder if there's a guide somewhere that.
But I actually, on viewing it again for this, I was like, wow. I wonder if that's even a foreshadowing of this race of people is usually in some sort of servant mode, subservient, and so that even makes the case for her to rebel, which we'll get into, obviously. That's even makes it even more profound.
That's possible. I don't know. That it always bothers me. So the next thing that I want to talk about is it's one of these things that people always harp on about when they don't pay attention to the movies. It bugs me. We're in a world of spaceships and interstellar travel and laser guns. I think that they could have come up with a solution to a AA battery. So people, shut up about the batteries. If you can accept aliens, you can accept the fact that somewhere on the Ravager ship, they figured out a way to replicate a AA battery. That's how his Walkman still works. Okay? Like every time there's a criticism, someone says something about that. And I'm like, come on, people.
Are you serious? People have a problem with that?
Yes. Like it's suspension of disbelief. Well, how do you find AA batteries? How do you find AA? I'm like, he's on a freaking rocket ship.
Well, they're Ravagers. It's not like it's the only time they've ever been to Earth. They go to Earth and stop at a 7-Eleven and they pick up a couple double A's.
That's true. That's true too. I love that. So anyway, so we meet the Ravagers, as they call in, and we see Sean Gunn.
Yes.
That is the director's brother, but also known as Kirk from Gilmore Girls. He's just basically a glorified extra, speaking extra on this. He doesn't have a ton of stuff to do, but he's always there. And while they were shooting the movie, he played Rocket. So they would have him in knee pads and stuff too, and he would be the speaking double for right. So when the actors are reacting to Rocket, they're actually reacting to Sean Gunn.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So and of course we have Yondu. We meet Yondu for the first time.
You're telling me that Bradley Cooper, this might have been his easiest paycheck ever.
I would say second only to Vin Diesel.
Yeah, really? No kidding.
Who did his entire role, I believe, in 2 hours.
Right.
Not to say that he didn't do a fantastic job.
Did a great job.
There's difficult paychecks. There's easy paychecks. You know. Yeah. So I think Bradley Cooper is as a voice actor is actually really really good.
Oh, he's excellent.
Because not everybody can do that thing. But Yondu. So Yondu is Michael Rooker, who is interesting. His career had sort of fallen off because he was big in the '90s for a very short window of time, probably about 3 years. Cliffhanger, Mallrats, and nothing else I can think of off the top of my head. And then he's just sort of disappeared. And then suddenly The Walking Dead shows up and he becomes Merle, and boom, he explodes. Like, he becomes a big hit on the con scene. Everybody loves him again. And then he comes in, and I think actually he was in Slither too, now I think about it. He comes back and shows up as Yondu. And so Yondu, the character, actually is from that original 1969 Guardians of the Galaxy. He was very much of a Legolas type. He was a very proud kind of, and he also had a mystical space age stuff, but I mean, mystical bow that the arrow would go wherever he commanded. And that's where you get sort of the arrow thing. So a completely different character than what this is, except for name and Mohawk and arrow. But that's sort of where he came from. And now, of course, like I said, Marvel has made it so that there is another Yondu in the Marvel Universe who looks and acts just like the one from the movie. And then it just happens they happen to have the same name as the guy who's going to be in the future. So, future descendant? I don't know. So, yeah, so we meet the Ravagers. These Ravagers are the people who kidnapped Peter and raised him and did not eat him.
Yes. It's
something they like to bring up at every opportunity.
There's a theory on that, and we'll get to it later with the Yondu scene. I wonder how much of this, because obviously, for those of you who've seen Volume 2, you understand more of the relationship between Yondu and Peter.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that's just his way of, I'm going to just stick to this because this is keeping me from making you realize how much I actually care for you.
Yeah, that's the mark of a good sequel, that you can go back to the original and see new things. Like, oh, okay.
Absolutely.
And even if that's retconning, I'm totally fine with it. So you can like look at it and go, all right, this is his version of tough love. Okay,
right.
I can see that. Because he is pretty hard to love in this movie.
Absolutely. He's
pretty gruff and definitely an antagonist. And then it's sort of like every time he shows up, it's like, oh God, here we go again.
Yeah. Exactly.
And speaking of, oh God, here's this guy again, we meet Ronan the Accuser. So another vastly different from the comics. He is very much of a judge, jury, executioner working for the state. Of the Kree, as opposed to as a zealot against them. But same kind of thing, he's like has a cosmic hammer and all that stuff. He wasn't quite that crazy. I feel Lee Pace plays him, who ended up playing, I can't remember the character's name now, but from the Hobbit movies, he was Legolas's father.
Oh.
Yeah, and also from Pushing Daisies, which is a fantastic show. So if you like Lee Pace, check out Pushing Daisies.
Okay, so this is my only thing I don't like about this movie. It's not that I don't like about it, but I've never understood it. What is the introduction? What does that introduction scene of Ronan mean?
I don't know. I really don't get it. Like, he's bathing in some kind of black ooze, and then I get the zealot thing. So this is like, it's all ritual, it's all ceremonial, but I don't know what the hell's going on, and it never is referenced later on.
Because they do such a great job in this movie of actually explaining stuff in some really creative ways.
Yeah.
This is the one scene where I'm like, okay, I'm just assuming he's either being created or this is his rejuvenation chamber or whatever you want to call it.
That's kind of what I got think an Empire where Darth Vader has his little cabana.
Meditation chamber, right.
Yeah, yeah. Same kind of thing here. Like, I guess he sleeps in the ooze. I don't know, but he comes out of it and then he has like his priestesses that like dress him in his ceremonial stuff and like puts the war paint on essentially and then kills a dude and then the blood pours down onto a symbol or something, but like none of that is ever referenced again.
I think it's literally just there to just show his brutality,
I guess,
and his savagery.
Yeah, it is a little weird. I mean, it's like it's well shot and stuff too. But yeah, I never really understood what that was about. I kind of feel bad for Lee Pace because again, kind of like we're right in the middle of the Phase 2 Marvel villain problem. I know there are people. I like the guy, the actor, but. And I like the character, but it just doesn't work. Like, you could swap him out with Malekith, and neither movie would have to change at all. He's just crazy, like, you know, a good actor wearing makeup, you know, with his big pronouncements about how he's going to destroy everything and kill everybody for reasons. Oh, all right. But luckily, he's not alone. He has the sisters. He has Gamora and he has Nebula, who I think carry more of the weight of the villain stuff in this too, because they have a lot more personality. In Nebula, we have an almost unrecognizable Karen Gillan.
Amazing.
Man. For those of you who don't know, she's from Doctor Who. She was Amy Pond for a couple of years, a couple seasons of Doctor Who, and had very, very long hair and all that, and for this shaved her head so she could be Nebula, and under a really a severe amount of makeup.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean,
It's really good makeup too.
You really get the sense that she is half cyber, half human,
yeah.
Or half whatever.
They really did a good job of like conveying that there's pieces of her that have been taken off and not right. Nicely melded together, sort of like right. Patchwork together. It's a really nice. And then we meet her sister Gamora, known as the most dangerous woman in the galaxy, and the two hate each other and they fight and they don't like him, and it's like this nice little like cabal of people who don't like each other but have to get along to do evil.
Exactly.
So Gamora convinces Ronan that she should be the one to go and retrieve the orb from Peter Quill because Korath screwed it up. Sorry, Korath. So then we go to Xandar. So we meet. This is the home of the Nova Corps. So the Nova is very different in the comics. The Nova Corps are very much like the Green Lanterns in Marvel Comics. They all have these bucket helmets that have the same kind of, like, they have energy powers. They can fly through space. They can communicate along these long distances. They can shoot energy. They're not in ships. So you can kind of see that where they're headed. Like, at some point in the Marvel Universe, Marvel Cinematic Universe, we might see a Nova like that. Like, you know, it's like the technology is advancing. This would be an earlier version of that, which I'm fine with them being space cops. That's totally cool. But you can kind of see that at some point they're probably, we will see a Nova, the traditional way in the gold armor, that flying around. So this is just another minor, quibble. So we have Peter, and then we find out that everybody wants this orb. The orb's the most precious thing ever. So Gamora, assassin, murderer, daughter of Thanos, one of the most dangerous women in the galaxy. Her plan to get the orb is kick the guy and run fast. That's it. That's her whole plan. I was like, okay. I mean, I get the fact that she didn't probably want to kill him, which is fine. You know, like, she's like, at this point, she's like sort of activating her moral plan. Like, this is like, I've done terrible things. I want to do that. And I'm fine with that. It's just the, like, you didn't have any spacey thing to disable him or to do that. I mean, it really was just kick him, grab it, and run. And that's, but from that, we get an amazing action sequences that's really funny, that we get to see some great special effects. Everybody in character doing all this stuff, you know, Groot being a lovable idiot and Rocket being extremely violent.
Isn't this such a phenomenal introduction to this version of Rocket and Groot?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the don't drink the fountain water, the entire sequence of that is such a wonderful, you immediately understand that Rocket, you get who he is, and you immediately get who Groot is.
Yes.
And you're just like, okay, I'm in, I'm sold.
Yeah.
At this point, all that's left is, which we'll get to the Drax introduction.
Yes.
You are sold on this merry band of stragglers.
Yes, because up until this point, everyone has just been a guy with a fig on their face. You know, I mean,
exactly.
Or makeup and stuff too, which I'm not discounting what the makeup department did, because I think even I look at it again, and Gamora's makeup is just fantastic. I mean, Nebula's is great too, like we were saying, but like just how close they can get, and you never get the impression of that somebody green with green paint all over their face.
Right.
But then, yeah, so then we have the two characters who could very easily have gone so very, very wrong. You have a raccoon with a gun and a talking tree. And you're right, in a very short amount of time, they establish them as some of the most interesting characters in the whole movie. And like, you're right on board. And you're right, starting with the voiceover of like what Rocket thinks of the world is great. I hate everybody. They're all stupid. And then, yeah, you're like Groot drinking the water as being like the big dumb idiot. And you get that short guy, tall guy, you know, comedy duo thing right away.
It's excellent. It's just... It's so pitch perfect. The whole thing is excellent.
Yeah, so we have Rocket played by Bradley Cooper and Groot played by Vin Diesel. And I think both of them do a fantastic voice acting job. And I think what I like about it is this could easily have been, for Bradley Cooper, another like, great, another just cash the paycheck thing. But he commits. I mean, he's funny, which we know Bradley Cooper can be. But like later on, when there's some pathos, man, like he really is going for it. And I think that is great. It was a great piece of casting. I'm not sure when that came in, like how far in advance they knew that they were going to have the guy, or if they were sort of shopping around. Boy, he was the right choice. So now they're captured. So then we have the prison lineup scene. So from what I understand, they put the prison lineup scene in the trailer. That's one of the first things we ever saw, was all five of them together, which all five of them are not together. They were not arrested at the same time. So that was a fabrication.
Wait, two things to put in before that. Dewey Cox.
Oh, yeah. That's right. John C. Reilly.
And I'm going to tell you this. When they get to meet Nova Prime, I had not ever heard that Glenn Close was in this movie.
Yeah, I can't remember hearing that either. Or even thought that maybe maybe she's going to have a weird one-note cameo. But no, she has a full role.
And this was one of those moments where when I was in the theater, when she came on the screen, you saw all the people in the theater who were there because they were dragged there by somebody else. They were like, Glenn Close is in this movie? Like, what is this? So anyway, just want to put that in.
Maybe that's on the commentary or something too. I didn't listen to it, but how the hell did you get Glenn Close?
Well, then right there, I think it's the conversation, and I keep saying Dewey Cox because I know his character has an actual name. Yeah. But he says something about he's talking like, oh no, he's just a prick. Uh-huh. And another one of my this is a Disney movie flag goes up like, what is going on? Right,
because they do the lineup. So they did the lineup, and the lineup was in the trailer. Obviously, it was different in the trailer because Drax was there. He's not in this, but it was a way to establish characters. The reaction to that trailer was so huge that James Gunn actually went back in and recut the lineup scene because it was very, very. It was only a very small part of it, and so he took pieces that he had shot just for the trailer and put them back in the movie because people responded to it so well. And that's where you get Peter Serafinowicz, the current Tick. Who's on the Amazon series? Who's doing a fantastic job, by the way. Oh, yeah. That's where you get the what a bunch of a-holes. In a Disney movie.
And here's the thing: the lineup scene. One, it's a phenomenal plot device to actually explain the backgrounds of all these characters. I mean, I think it's just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
But two, okay, here's the funny part, and this is another part that made me laugh is. In the trailer, they block out the middle finger when he does it because it's in the trailer.
That's right.
And in the movie, they don't at all. And when I saw it again last night, I went, wow, Shuri from Black Panther has that scene to thank for her big comedic introduction in Black Panther.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. But it's already established that this is a thing in the Marvel thing. So
exactly. I was just like, okay, that's amazing.
All right. So then we move to the kiln, the prison that they get thrown into.
And do you love do you love all of the pop culture references that are thrown in on the walk?
Oh yeah.
He gets in Ark of the Covenant, Maltese Falcon, and the Giving Tree.
And we first learn about the Groot's interesting speech impediment. Now, what they had in the comic, he was like that in the comics too. Groot was originally created, he was a Jack Kirby monster. He was just like the Groot from Planet X. He was just another one of the many, many just mindless monsters. The Abnett Lanning brought him back and they put him into the comic as this character that only said, I am Groot, and no one can understand. But what they revealed later on is that he is actually saying stuff, and it's so complicated that only really advanced minds can understand it. Everyone else just hears, I am Groot. So he actually is saying this. So that's they play a little bit with that in this movie because Rocket can understand him, but no one else really can. So it sort of it goes in and out a little bit too because he actually is saying stuff. And from what I understand, Vin Diesel is actually given a script with Groot's real lines in it. And so he can read it and say I'm worried we're not going to survive this. He can read his I am Groot as what Groot is really saying.
So his intonation and his inflection is all based on what he's actually trying to say. Oh, that's awesome.
So people, we ragged on about this is the easiest paycheck, but I mean, he is doing some real work there. So it isn't just him, he just reads it 15 different ways and they can just pick and choose which one they want to do. He really is following along in the movie and really doing something. So did you, this is interesting, so I'll lead into this. They get accosted by a big bruiser of an alien. Do you know who that is?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, I think he's technically called Big Blue Bastard.
Right? Oh, is that what's credited as?
I think that's funny. But yes, Spencer Wilder.
No. The big guy, when they walk into the sort of general population and they're going around, the big guy who says, I'm going to slather you up with
Brigadier General. Oh, no, wait, who's that guy?
That's Nathan Fillion.
No way. That's awesome.
Yes, because he and James Gunn are friends from Slither. So he actually shows up in almost all of James Gunn's movies. His cameo unfortunately got cut from Volume 2, but that's his voice. If you listen to it, they do a little bit of alien modification to it, but once you know, when you hear it, you go, oh yeah, that's Nathan Fillion. So that's the one that Groot sticks his fingers up his nose. That's Nathan Fillion. Oh, and go ahead, in that same scene, In that same scene, as we're going to cameos, in that same scene, when there are people up in the upper decks who are yelling at them, throwing stuff.
Right.
One of the people up there is Lloyd Kaufman, founder of Troma Entertainment. He's the little, he's like the old guy, like the little, this like this little, you know, boo, boo, and like throwing stuff at them. That's how he gave Lloyd a cameo in there.
Okay, so you know what I was talking about was the guy who takes the Walkman.
No, I had not thought of that, but yeah.
So right before they make it into the big atrium. They're walking through the place. He has the pop culture references. Then there's this, that's the big blue bastard. He basically takes the walk when there's a fight. That guy is played by Spencer Wilding. Spencer Wilding played Darth Vader, the Darth Vader scenes in Rogue One.
Oh, okay. So he's like a stuntman performer.
Extraordinaire. And he's done, and actually I looked up at his IMDb. He actually also played, he's played several big characters in the recent last few years of Doctor Who.
Oh, so okay.
I think he's in, he's the Wooden King and the Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe. He's in the God Complex. He's the new Dave Prowse.
Oh, yeah. There you go. That's a good idea. Yeah.
Wow, then that's this whole sequence is loaded.
Yeah,
with references. That's great.
So then from here we get our first glimpse of Drax. Drax the Destroyer, played by Dave Bautista. Now, again, on paper, if you'd sat me down and said, you know, there's a Marvel movie coming out, and one of the funniest performers in it is going to be a WWE superstar. Like, you mean The Rock? No, not The Rock.
Because I am a fan of WWE programming, okay. And I will just tell you, knowing Batista as he was known when he was wrestling, you would never think he was capable of the comedic timing and the heart that this movie has.
Yeah.
Like it would just, you would never think that in a million years. He is this, I think, a scene stealer throughout the rest of this movie.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's once again, I'm talking about birth of a movie star. It's sort of like, where did this guy come from? Like, it's rare you see someone like that make the transition and just become universally beloved.
He owns it. Oh, absolutely.
The Rock is fantastic, but it took him a couple of tries before people went, oh yeah, Dwayne Johnson, got it. Like, he had a couple swings at the bat before he really, really connected with something. And like right out of the bat, Dave Bautista, he's like, oh, we love him. Like, he's just the guy, and everything he's been in, it's always something interesting. Like, he was born to do this. It's fantastic. And also very different from in the comics. It's really complicated, but it ended up with like Thanos came to Earth and killed a human. Like, I think his name was Arthur, his wife and child. And Arthur got his body or his mind transferred into a new body so he could kill Thanos, and that became Drax. And he was like a former saxophone player. Like there's all this weird 70s Marvel trivia stuff
that's
around
Drax.
He used to wear a big purple cape. I mean, like from that to this is a huge thing. But it also gets into another one of my annoyances about Marvel. And I had the same problem when they had Black Widow standing with the Avengers. You've got God of Thunder, Hulk, Captain America, Super Soldier with the shield, and Iron Man in his suit, and Black Widow with her pistol. Okay, so in this we have Star-Lord, who we'll eventually learn has some stuff there, but he's basically just a dude. He's got the cool gadgets and stuff too. And you've got Gamora, who's a trained assassin and has some cybernetic stuff that in her system. Rocket Raccoon and Groot both have their own special abilities. And as far as we know, Drax is just a tattooed guy who carries a knife. Like
what? No.
They never say anything about any special abilities he has. Like they never say he's stronger, faster, has healing abilities, like nothing. They say nothing about what his stuff is like. So
they don't need to. You see it. He's got muscles on top of muscles.
He is. He's a big dude, but in a world of Thanos's, big muscles don't mean a whole lot. I mean, and he gets punked by Ronan right off the bat as soon as they meet. It's my annoyance because Drax, like obviously in the comics he could fly and he could shoot lasers. They're not going to do that. But even to have something, we learn his whole origin story in the next 5 minutes of the movie, and they never say anything about like I subjected myself to this thing that would make me immune to pain or I mean anything. He's as far as we know, he's just a bouncer. Like he's, I'm nothing against the character or the performance or anything, but he sort of tags along and he ends up looking like they're like, oh, that guy. It bothers me, you know. Make something up, people. Make something up.
Okay, so my problem, and again, this is such a minor problem. But when he's telling the story about him, all I kept thinking of, and just go ahead and laugh at this. all I kept thinking is how funny it would be as he's telling the story, Ronan killed my wife and daughter, and I'm going to avenge them. And I wanted Russell Crowe to pop out of the side of the screen and go, yo, dude, that's my story, right?
Story. Not entertained.
And then I want Korath, and then I want Korath to show up and hand him the little bag of the little figurines. And come on, if any of you are listening, if you haven't seen Gladiator, you should see Gladiator, and then you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't even put that together, but you're absolutely right. It's the same. And he laughed. Yeah.
Well, no, but that's a good point, though. That's a good point.
But yeah, even that of like I worked my way through the fighting pits, and so that's why I was from a high gravity planet. I mean, there's a thousand different things you could have done. But as far as we know, he's just an angry tattooed guy with a knife. So, in the course of the guy, one of the things I wrote down just to make a note of is I never think of Rocket as being a CGI creature.
Oh no, not at all.
They were so good at how they did that, and one of the things that made me laugh so hard and also be so technically amazed is when Rocket wakes up from the cuddle pile of all of the prisoners, his fur is matted.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, what a cool little affectation. Like,
absolutely.
Somewhere out there, deep in the bowels of Marvel Digital, a programmer slaved for weeks to get the proper amount of matted fur. And sir, I salute you because it was worth it.
Well, even the rendering earlier when they have the shower scene where they have to get like disinfected, and you see the scars on his back.
Yes.
It's I mean, you know, it's a real moment. Like, it's great.
It's never, and Marvel occasionally has some digital issues where like their people don't really look like people, right. But I never once in this movie thought, wow, they've done a lot of good render time on Rocket.
Absolutely.
Or actually, again, Groot to his extra step, but Groot obviously is a giant tree thing, so he looks unnatural to begin with, but Rocket is supposed to be just another person, just happens to be furry. Yeah, I think it's awesome. We cut away to the bad guys doing their bad guy scheming, and we have the return of the Other, played by Alexis Denisov. Again, unrecognizable under all the makeup, as him giving, he's like, "Ooh, you better not cross Thanos. You better not."
Yeah.
More posing. And I think that's when he actually summons him. You need to come talk to the boss. But meanwhile, back at the kiln, we have the escape. Terrific action sequences. This is something that you would not expect James Gunn to be this good at, but to be doing comedy and action and storytelling of characters at the same time, it's tremendous. Like the whole kill and escape is just a masterclass in how you put together an action
sequence. And how wonderful. I mean, like, you know, we could talk about the whole, like, the comedy of this movie. You know, even going back to the previous scene where, like, you know, they save Gamora, obviously, for not getting killed. And, you know, Drax is like, you know, I'm going to keep this knife. And, you know, the one guy's just like, well, that was my
knife. My favorite knife. Yeah.
Where they're sitting down. I love the wide shot. This is so beautifully done. The wide shot, as Rock is explaining, I need the security band, I need the leg, which is the greatest MacGuffin ever.
Yes.
You know, I need the battery. And you're like saying, oh my God, no, Groot's doing it right now. Turn around. But the best thing is, the best thing of that moment is he pulls the cover off, flings it, and it hits the guy in the head. It's so amazing.
I love that. I love that depth of field stuff. And no one does that.
Oh.
I remember watching a movie from the mid-80s, a really obscure comedy called Young Doctors in Love.
Oh, yeah.
There's no reason. It's Michael McKean and Sean Young. There's no reason anyone remember. But there's one scene in it where it's basically like, you know, the two doctors are in the break room are having this intense discussion about, like, you know, the cut and someone dying and all stuff. But in the background there is there's a little person and they're talking on the telephone and the telephone is mounted high on the wall and he finishes the conversation and tries to hang up the phone and realizes that it's like 2 feet above his head. And can't hang up the phone.
That's awesome.
And so while this conversation is going on, there's this whole thing going in all these ways he's trying to hang up this phone. It's this absurd thing, but it's not the focus of the scene. That's not what it's happening in the background.
And
that's the first time I ever remember seeing that and being like, wait a minute, you can have two things going on at once in the movie. That's amazing. And almost no one does this, but you're absolutely right. Seeing it all playing out there as they're having this conversation, you're like, guys, if you could just turn and, if you could just...
Well, no, because you get to that point where you're like, go, wait. Oh, no, never mind. I want to see what happens next. Go ahead.
Very rarely do I find that I do I laugh at something that was done by CGI?
Yes.
You know, yeah. Like, and that was an exception because, like, they did it so well in terms of, like, what was going on that, like, you know, it's, he flunks the thing and the guy falls over. And I think it was, like, the guy legitimately fell over. It wasn't, like, a CGI guy, CGI falling over.
Right.
But everything else around it was fake. But it was just, like, the timing of it was perfect. And it's really funny and it's so silly, which I love. In a movie like this, they could take time to just be silly.
Totally.
So the, and so a great action sequence of them escaping and then Peter, you know, sort of kind of double crossing them to, because he knew he couldn't trust them. So he keeps the orb for himself, which is a nice little character thing too. That's a smart criminal, and then makes his big escape to the Pina Colada song. As he like, it's like, there he is. Like as he comes rocketing out with his mask on, flying through space,
which, you know, I never realized the name of that song is actually Escape.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. Escape, the Pina Colada song.
It's just fantastic. Like, okay, I love, there's a few moments in this movie, and you have one of them when they enter the main watchtower room, where they have the, which mm-hmm. I call them the Guardians Assemble scene, where they're all standing yeah. there, and the theme is playing, and you're just like, yes! It's just so great.
Yeah, that, I forgot, one of my favorite, there's a lot of great, great lines in this movie, too. Like, I've been remiss to talk about that. I've talked about so much in the Avengers one about how him great lines. There's almost as many in Guardians of the Galaxy where Rocket is trying to explain to Peter that Drax's people don't understand metaphors. And then he says something like, it'll just go right over his head. It would not fly over my head. My reflexes are too fast. I would catch it.
Oh, it's perfect timing. Oh my God. And again, Batista is just amazing. Like the way he delivers it is perfect. But okay, he flies back to the ship, gets into the ship. And there's this moment where Drax and him have the conversation, right? About, you know, he went, what did you go back for? What was the great thing? He shows it to him and Drax is like, you're an imbecile.
Yeah.
How does Drax know what a Walkman is?
Yeah, that's true. Like, because if it was one of the four when they came in, they would know because Peter had that big fight scene with the guy
right.
when they were walking in. Like, that's my song. But yeah, you're right. Drax would have no idea what it is.
I always think that weird is just, that scene is weird to me. Now we come to,
yeah.
well, no, right before this though, I want to say the greatest Disney, this is a Disney movie moment. The Jackson Pollock joke is just insane.
I know. It's one of those things where like I saw my daughter, she's like, what does that mean? I'm like, you're not old enough to know.
Hey, dude, don't worry about it. Yeah, don't worry about it. It's just the ship is filthy. Like, okay, I gotta say though, I have to admit, mm-hmm. like as funny as it is, I still
I know
believe that they
I know.
Let
I
that
guess
go
they
through.
They figured it's enough. It's either you're well cultured enough to know what it means, or by the time you go and do the research to find out why that's such a disgusting joke, that you'll be long out of the theater.
Yeah, it's over. Don't worry about it. Move on.
So we come to nowhere in the floating head of a celestial. Celestials are giant godlike robots of the Marvel Universe. And so when the Collector later on is telling his story, and you see one of them, holy thing, that's a celestial. That's the big robot thing that sort of smashes and then destroys the whole planet. They're sort of like these vast, unknowable godlike creature that just show up and do stuff. And no one really knows what their deal is. And so one of them has died at some point, and this is the head. And so people, it's so big, they actually live inside the head. This was the Guardians were based out of here for a long time. And it was run by a telepathic Russian dog named Cosimo, who we see in a cameo, as they walk into the Collector's thing, right. There he is. That was one of those, as a hardcore Guardians fan, that was one of those, oh, hey! Because later on, in the comic books, he runs. It was the idea was that he was a Russian dog astronaut that was shot into space and kept going and basically was like bombarded with cosmic rays or something, as most of them were, and developed these abilities and now landed in nowhere. And he actually runs the place, so he is a telepathic Russian dog. So yeah, they just show him. He's just like they just pass by, and there he is.
Once again, in the year 47232, when Starman returns in his red roadster, Tesla roadster.
Right.
You bastards should have known it was coming. Like seriously.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, they have time in Infinity War to have him like bounce off of one of the ships as they're coming into land. Punk.
Exactly.
So we meet Benicio del Toro as the Collector, being as Benicio del Toro as he could possibly be. I just love it. He's so weird in the post-credit scene for Thor Dark World where they bring him the ether. That it's just like in here, he's just as, and of course it was, you know, obviously written, shot by the same person, but he's just bizarre and weird, and I love it.
Yeah.
So and later on, for you fans who have seen everything up to now, he in the continuity of the comics is actually the brother of the Grand Master, who is played by Jeff Goldblum. So in the Guardians of the Galaxy ride,
they have an affinity for a little goatee, that little mark on their bottom lip.
Exactly. Yeah, and also messing with the mortals, because they talk about it's the Tavan Mining Company has been harvesting from the Celestial Head for hundreds of years. Well, guess who created the Tavan Mining Company? Tamir Tavan, the Collector. So it's him. He's been around for hundreds. He's thousands of years old. So there's actually a Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout at Disneyland. There is actually a painting, quote unquote, of the two of them together playing a game.
Oh, so that's awesome.
They've already sort of like quietly went like, oh, by the way, we're aware of this connection, guys, and we're playing with it. So I hope before the end of the second Avengers movie, Infinity War Part 2, whatever that ends up being, that we see these two crazy cats get together. The amount of acting that will be going on in that scene will just melt the lens. Like the two of them just completely just being their weird selves. Put Christopher Walken in and the whole thing might just implode.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
So we get to see a lot of little cameos and surprises in the collector's cases. We get to see a dark elf from Thor the Dark World. And there is a Chitauri from the Chitauri invasion of Earth. So he's got like, and then we get a lot of exposition laid out in a very little way. Like, here's what the Infinity Stones are. Right. Like for the first time, they actually sit down to, and you see the Tesseract. So you can already make that connection. And you see a picture as Groot tries to grab it. So to that, we learned Tesseract, Ether, and now this one. The orb are all connected to each other and the most powerful things in the universe because they are older than the universe. So we get the big fight scene. Drax gets punked, just casually tossed aside. And we could see Nebula being a full-on villain. I'm glad that we got to see more of her in the sequel too, because she's great in this one, but I like seeing the sort of how it plays out at this angry, angry woman and find out why. So we get to... the big chasing in the ship. Again, another fantastic action scene, flying around in the little pods that can burst through, are so tough they can fly through everything. And then we have Gamora gets, basically she's going to die, and Peter Quill, like this is like his big hero moment. I also like the fact that he sees it, accepts what he's going to do, and is annoyed by it.
Oh, yeah.
That I thought, you can tell very much like that Han Solo was, and Indiana Jones was sort of on James Gunn's mind when he was doing this, but like it's that, oh, hell. Like he's like, because he knows what's going to happen. He's like, oh man, I really hope this works, and goes out and flies out and saves her. Now, the cool thing about that sequence is they actually shot that scene underwater.
Oh, wow.
And then digitally removed all, like, essentially all of the water and stuff, too. I don't know if they actually had a green screen underwater or not, or just, you know, hand did it or whatever. But if you watch it, you can see their hair is, like, waving, and, like, you can see sort of, like, on their skin and stuff, too. I thought it was a really cool way of showing that they're not just suspended on wires in front of a green screen in Atlanta.
Oh, that's a fantastic. That explains why it looks so good. It looks completely surreal. Yeah.
Yeah. A great idea that I think was executed extremely well by, you know, a ton of people.
So, you know, one thing I want to just add on this is, okay, so as I was seeing the scene, it never occurred to me until I rewatched it. This is where Yondu gets or at least it's the foreshadowing of what Yondu does in Volume 2.
How so?
Okay. So, Star-Lord goes to, again, families are built by sacrificial love.
Yes.
Star-Lord is like, I'm going to sacrifice myself. I am going to go into the vacuum of space. I only have one thing that can save one of the two of us. I'm going to put it on you, and I'm going to sacrifice myself. And right before he does it, he radios Yondu and says, here's where my coordinates are. So when Yondu comes, he sees what Peter has done.
Huh. Yeah.
And I realized, wow, that's where... I mean, it's a little bit of foreshadowing, and that's where Yondu, you watch him when we go to watch Volume 2, which we will in the future, when he has that moment he's saying, I know what I'm going to do with these things because I've seen Peter do it.
Yeah. Hmm. I like that. I like even if that's ends up being a retcon, headcanon accepted. Absolutely. I like it. You just filed that away and we're like, oh, I'm gonna have to do that. Oh no, I have to do that too. So then we get to see the Guardians sort of become the Guardians, like the five of them like on the Ravager ship pull together and I have 12% of a plan. I mean, like this is the thing, is a lot of these movies you get so into like the explosions and the fight scenes and that stuff, and that in this movie especially, that's all great, but these are the scenes that I really dig into. Like, so it's the five of them just in a room arguing and two of them weren't there, like that's what I find so fascinating about it. But there, I mean, there's so much great, there's comedy, Drax is not paying attention and Rocket is like the whole it's a fake laugh and do I have to stand up too, I mean, like all that stuff, but it all just seems so natural. Like this, like you said, like the family, like they're all sort of pulling together for the first time. Like, all right, let's do this. And then we get the big, it goes into the big montage scene to Cherry Bomb.
Oh, so can I admit my tears?
Sure.
Okay. So when Peter has the big moment where he says, look, you know, I need your help. I look around, I see we're all losers. Mm-hmm. And we're the people who've lost stuff. Today we get a chance. And he says to give for our podcast listeners, I won't say it, you know, and not run away. And I was like, wow, that's amazing, because that's what everybody, I mean, that's a great message. I just think that's a fantastic message. But when Drax says, I'm just going to admit it, when he says, you know, Gamora's like, you know, I live most of my life surrounded by my enemies and will be grateful to die among friends. And I'm like, okay, that's really cool. But when Drax says, well, I'm going to honor to fight with you until the death, and I will see my wife and daughter again.
Uh-huh.
Dude, the first time I saw the movie, I cried a little right there.
Yeah, it's good. And once again, that's a wrestler in body paint.
Oh my God, it's so good.
It's just, I know, I'm not trying to date on him. It's just like, it's from unexpected sources. That's like he's so great in this. Like so much better than, I've seen people who've done a dozen movies who can't pull what he does in his, like, basically his first film.
And what great character development. To where you care that much for that character in that moment of the film. It's just fantastic.
And then half the CGI budget goes all over the screen. Ships coming down and the Nova Corps building their barrier and the Ravagers on the ground shooting the Sakaaran ships down, which, by the way, is Sakaaran. Another little foreshadowing thing.
Right.
But so we'd end up on Sakaar. And then one of my other favorite lines too, where they get through and Gamora turns and with just like joy on her face goes, we're just like Kevin Bacon.
Jeez.
Oh, I love that.
Well, because it is the Legend of Footloose.
The Legend of Footloose.
We also, we didn't mention the John Stamoses of the planet Earth.
That's right.
The heroes. Like,
yeah, so if they're doing this film now, then they would actually have John Stamos show up at some
point. Of course they would, right.
So we get through and we have the another big fight, actually, because again, alas, poor Korath just gets his circuitry ripped out of it. And then we have them fight through, and then Groot puts out his light up spores. There's like the like, oh, like, and that's another thing where you know that a very confident filmmaker who's just like, you know what, huge action sequences, stuff blowing up, Prelan's about to die, I'm gonna take a moment just to do something kind of cool. It's just a quiet moment where they're just like, they're looking at all these bioluminescent spores floating around, they're all like, huh, how about that? Just take a moment and they move on with the film. Now we're gonna get to my other my other problem that always bugs the crap out of me. Okay, so they're going along and they're like okay, they're getting ready to face off, and like it's the five of them, they're all together, like we're having a moment, and Drax is having his big moment. He's like, you're my family and I love you, like, you know, that whole thing. And he's like, you know, this big dumb tree thing, he's going on and he's like, even this green whore. And I was like, really, you had to? Oh, it bugs the crap out of me, because it's like, why Of there's so few female characters in this. You have a badass girl and you automatically reduce her to a whore. And also, why is Drax the one saying this?
He has no. Okay, wait. Here's why. He has no tact, because he doesn't.
Yes, but why? Like, of all things to pick out of the air.
Well, that's true. That is
my problem with it.
Yeah.
If it had been something that someone had said, like, now James Gunn has actually apologized for this.
Oh, really?
And he said. Yes, he actually, I mean, like, you can go online, and I'm paraphrasing, but he has said, do not blame Drax, that was my fault, that was me, that was me as a filmmaker failing. His intention was, someone had called her that in the prison, Drax overheard it, and just being Drax went, okay, that's something else that she does. Pilot You know, they, like, whore. Like, it was like something else that he had heard. He wasn't especially like, you're a whore. Like, it was just right. Like, oh, yeah, somebody called her that. But that doesn't happen in the movie. So we're meant to just like extrapolate that thing. So you know, I realize this is sort of a dead issue for some of the things, but I watch it and oh god, it irks me every single time I see it.
Good point.
Yeah. That was for when I took a drink. Right.
All good.
Also, the part of it is because it's such a great moment otherwise. But then so they go through and we see the great fight. We get to see Nebula, and Nebula has her big speech, and she gets shot with a rocket in the middle of it, which is awesome.
Totally.
I always love speech interruptus. That's one of my favorite gags. And so then we see her like why that she's looks like she does is because she has this self-repair thing built in that horribly painfully puts her back together when she gets damaged. Yeah, then they get to Thanos, they shoot him with the thing. Nope. Sorry. Can't shoot an Infinity Stone or one who wields it. We come down to explosions and fire and crash down to the planet, and then we get to the great, great, great scene of the final confrontation, which is almost like it's almost a parody of the confrontation. Which I like too. So this is not them just, you know, just like, you know, fighting and shooting and punching. It's starts with the dance off, and it's all because it's a distraction.
Wait, you can't skip. You can't skip.
What did I skip?
The death of Groot.
Oh, the death of Groot. Yes, of course. Death of Groot. Yeah. Groot sacrifices himself. Like we're all going to die. Groot sacrifices himself and Rocket knows he's doing this to save the group. And utters, of course, we are Groot. This has come up again recently because James Gunn has had to come out and say, no, the intention was that Groot that you learned that you met in Guardians of the Galaxy is dead. Like that was his sacrifice. He sacrificed himself to save his family. And so the Groot we see in later on stuff is his essentially his son. It's a sapling. It is not the same person coming back to life. It is a new person.
Right.
So it is a big sacrifice. So yeah. So then they crash down to the planet because of Groot. They survive enough to fight and fight Ronan. And he the dance off distraction is
dance off, bro.
Very off. Peter Quill. It's very funny. And then they shoot the thing in the power stone. Oh, and they're gonna grab it, and then Peter grabs it, and he's clearly going to die. Now that's the thing is later on in two we don't get too much into we said like, oh no, it's like he's the only one who's strong enough to do this. That's not true, because as you watch, as he's holding a stone, he's clearly going to be torn apart by it.
Right,
like his pieces of his face are being torn away. Like he is going to die. It's only through the group coming together, the four of them harnessing the power together, that they are able to survive.
And I will say the scene where I think it is just so brilliantly done, when he goes to grab the stone, Gamora says, "Take my hand," and he has the image of his mother on her deathbed.
His mom.
I'm going to tell you, and when it pans back to him, and it's him, regular Peter Quill, and that tear comes down his cheek.
Uh huh.
Man.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
That's good. That's good storytelling right there. Cause you're bringing the theme back around and stuff too, but like you in the middle of your big CG action sequence, like you take the moment to like, cause I mean, this whole thing is going to be Guardians of the Galaxy, Peter Quill's mommy issues. I mean, like he's dealing with a lot of that through the whole movie. And of course the sequel will be daddy issues. But then like it's the whole group of them coming together, self-sacrifice, like you're talking about, exactly. Like all of them pretty much assume they're going to die. I don't think that in Drax's mind is sort of like, oh, well, like this will save him. Like, I really think it's like, we're going to do this together.
No, we're
like,
going to do this together. We're going to go out together. Absolutely.
And that's why Rocket, and I like the little, as Rocket reaches, they do the sort of little, what's the painting of the Sistine Chapel?
The Creation of Man.
Yeah. So like you see Rocket reaching up to Drax's hand. There's one shot, just the two hands. It looks just like it. I thought that was a nice little nod. And then, yeah. So then together, the four of them, you know, are able to harness the power and take out Ronan.
And you got to just love the whole, but how? And he looks at him and says, you said it yourself.
That's right.
It's just so good. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, just bang. Then we get a little allusion to what Peter Quill's ancestry is, that there's something not quite different there. My wife was wondering why they put Gamora in a skirt at the end of it, but I thought, nah. Well, I mean, like, she's been hard. Maybe this is their way of sort of allowing her to be feminine.
They're humanizing her. I mean, she feels like she can make a change. She can become more human, for lack of a better term. Terran, whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Or at least more emotionally free, exactly, or whatever she can be, you know. But then, you know, he gets in, John C. Reilly comes back, and Seraphinus is there. Actually, Seraphinus had to sacrifice himself on the Nova ships. So then, yeah, the Guardians are off to, you know, guard into the future and cause all sorts of trouble. So we have our team.
So at the end, when they make all the allusions to your half Terran for Peter, mm-hmm. your father is something ancient. Did you have any idea what was when you first saw it, what was your thinking of who he was?
No, father. Yeah, because this is a total James Gunn thing. The idea that he has a for those of you who haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I won't spoil that thing, but like they get into it in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, it has some sort of power or something or other in there. I really didn't know. I really didn't know what they were referring to. Like I assumed it would be some sort of power cosmic. That's the fun thing in the Marvel Universe. There's cosmic power and there's power cosmic. I assumed it would be one of the two would be connected to it, but I didn't know what it was or where they were leading to. I mean, in the comic books, they've reworked it so that his father is the king of a planet, like a leader of another system, another planet called Spartax. So he is essentially a prince, but that is not the case in the movie at all. But yeah, I really didn't know where they were going with that. I think they were just opening up to sort of the weirder, cosmicer world, as we'll see in that one, that things are going to get pretty weird.
Well, and I would just add too, is, I mean, again, what a wonderful ending. I mean, I think the whole montage at the end, and I will admit, I shed a few tears. First of all, you've got Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, both,
yes.
right? I mean, yeah. It's the greatest song to end with. And I love the scene when you see, and I'm going to say Dewey Cox again, when he comes home and you realize he's got a family. And it's just so wonderful. Like, and they actually are in an earlier scene. Rocket actually saves them from getting kamikaze by one of the ships.
Yep. They're running across the bridge.
Yeah.
And he comes flying over and takes out one of the Sakaaran ships.
Oh,
yeah.
I love this movie.
Yeah. It is a great movie. And it is so confident.
Yes.
You can, like, James Gunn had an idea. He had a plan and he's what he was going to do. And he really, really pulled off something pretty amazing that has his fingerprints all over it. And yet still feels like a Marvel universe. So it doesn't feel like something completely removed, like an outlier from all the other ones. It still feels Marvel,
absolutely,
but it's so different than everything else. And you're right. From this, a lot of things. I mean, I don't think we would have Thor Ragnarok if it wasn't for Guardians of the Galaxy. The freedom, the aesthetic, the big bold choices for characters and for setting.
Right. No, I totally agree. And your post credit scene
is after we see the sproutling of Groot.
Oh, yes.
That in the mid credit at the end we see Howard the Duck. Howard the Duck is a longtime Marvel character. We're too late in the show to really get into Howard the Duck, but he is a longtime staple of and had a terrible, terrible movie in the 80s, but had some really terrific comics. And actually, they brought him back recently after around this time. They brought him back in the Marvel Universe and had done some interesting things with him, too. I think he's sort of now more dormant again. But yeah, it's written and created by Steve Gerber. He did some really, he was very much of a, I wouldn't say silly, but like a snarky sort of like character that he used to deal with some big issues in a very fun, silly kind of way. So yeah,
let's just say for those of you who go back and look for the old movie. Mm-hmm. The scene at the end of this one is better than that entire movie. That's
very true. His 2 minutes of screen time, voiced by Seth Green, were better than that entire movie. Yeah. It was. I cannot think of a situation where you should go back and watch Howard the Duck. So it looks like just lost connection with Rob. So there we go. So that was Guardians of the Galaxy. That was our next step on the road to infinity. From here, we are going back to Earth to deal with killer robots. We will be dealing with Avengers: Age of Ultron. I'd like to thank Rob for joining us. It was a blast, as always. Guardians of the Galaxy is one of the great, great Marvel films. I'm super glad to be able to go through and watch it again. It's always fun, even with my quibbles. It still is a great movie and worth watching. So thank you all for listening. Thank you to Engineer Alice. All the professionalism comes from her. All the mistakes are my own. Thank you, Rob, for sitting in and chatting about Guardians with me for an hour and plus. We'll be back next week, and we'll see you further on up the road. Thanks. You've been listening to the Road to Infinity podcast, brought to you by Legible Scrawl. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, or even at our website at www.legiblescrawl.com. We'll see you further on up the road.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.